The politics of immigration reform in the United States are front and center today, with calls for a wall on America's southern border and news of more aggressive enforcement by immigration and customs enforcement agents. Today's guest reminds us that these aren't just policy debates, these are people's lives we're debating. She's Gabriela Domanzine, this week on Story in the Public Square. Hello and welcome to Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University. Alongside me is my friend and co-host G. Wayne Miller of the Providence Journal. Story in the Public Square is an effort to explore stories that matter in American public life. And we do that by talking to storytellers, analysts, and advocates about the big stories. Today there is no story bigger than the debate over immigration. To help us make sense, we're joined by Gabriela Domanzine, a nationally recognized voice on immigration, who is the director of the Latino Policy Institute at Roger Williams University. Gabriela, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, though.
So we want to talk about the stuff that's in the headlines and in the news, but tell us a little bit about your story. How did you begin this journey that got you to where you are today?
Oof, it takes me back. My parents are from Mexico City, and they're both physicians, so I grew up in Miami, Florida. Very much kind of distant from the reality of what it is to be a Hispanic or a Latino, given Miami's population and how diverse it was. That being said, I spent all of my summers in Mexico City, and fortunately I had parents that wanted us to see the world, and we traveled a lot of places. And I don't know if I was born an empath or whether, you know, my parents who are doctors and healers, you know, really helped with that or put that in me. But it was always, I was always conscious of these differences between people. And, you know, some folks were better off and some weren't. My parents would always tell me, I just want you to know that everybody that you see is exactly like you, right? So I graduated, I left Miami. And after going to the University of Chicago, I landed at the National Council of La Raza, which is the nation's largest Hispanic civil rights organization. Right now it's called Unidos US, it's changed its name. And that's really where my eyes were open to a reality that I had never seen. I did not know that there were, at this point, 9 million people that were living without absolutely any rights in this country. I did not know that they were the reason why my lettuce was less than a dollar. I did not know that they couldn't speak up if they were treated poorly at work. And something, a conversation that I was fortunate to have with Wayne, I met on my first trip with the president of this organization, I met a farm worker. And it was my first time meeting a farm worker. I was, you know, 23 years old, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed out of college. And as we were leaving a gathering of farm workers in North Carolina, this man came up to me, and he was a tobacco picker. And he asked me what my boss was doing there. And I said, well, you know, he's the head of the civil rights movement for you. He's working for us. But I was really kind of fumbling the answer. It was, you know, and then he shook my hand. And I remember I had never in my life felt such a rough hand.
Right? Calloused.
Calloused, yeah. From the work, from the hours of picking tobacco. And then he asked me in Spanish, he said, Señorita, why do you care about me? And the idea that somebody that was doing such back-breaking work in order for us to be able to eat, to be able to smoke, to be all this stuff, right? Because they were tobacco pickers, would care that there was people, would think that there was people that didn't care about him, changed my life. Mm. So on the plane back, on the way to Washington, D.C., I became very, very obvious to me, and I told my boss that of all the farm workers that we had met that day and of all the people with absolutely no rights, only two people are going back to D.C., and only two people are going to be able to sit at the tables like this one and talk about these experiences. And I became an advocate ever since.
There's a I spend my days at the Pell Center in Newport, and Claiborne Pell, for whom the center is named, used to say that the duty of those to speak, or we have a duty to speak for those who cannot or dare not speak. And that sounds what you're talking about.
Absolutely.
These are folks who are not represented, who don't have a voice. That's more than a burden. It's an obligation.
It is. I mean, and I think that's the click that I made on that day, mm-hmm. right? So if they can't be there and I can, it is my obligation to speak for them. That being said, this is in the late 90s. Over the past, almost two decades, what we've seen is prior to this, undocumented folks were really, really scared and wouldn't come out and share their stories. But it's uncomfortable, right? And it's also not authentic if I, as somebody who grew up with a lot of privilege and a lot of luck, right, speak on behalf of or speak for folks whose day-to-day reality I've never come in contact with. So mm-hmm. most of us in the movement at around, in the early 2000s, what we started doing is finding folks that would actually be willing to share their story on camera, even if they were undocumented. The idea being that the more people knew about them, the more we would educate the American people as to what was happening. And also because only they can tell their stories, mm-hmm. right? Like it's the question, can a man lead the feminist movement? No, right? So it's been 20 years. It's been 20 years at the national level. I was at the National Council of La Raza. I then realized what you're talking about, representation, that Latinos and immigrants are barely in the news, are barely in the media. And how can we expect people to have a different opinion of Mexicans like myself if the only Latinos that they see on television are criminals, gang mm-hmm. members, et cetera. So I got really fixated with that and decided to become a journalist to change that reality and to share these stories. And then I ended up going to Washington, D.C. Because it was obvious to me that this community, and I think the Democratic Party still, I mean the Republican as well, but the Democratic Party still has a long way to go. They don't know how to reach this community. In a lot of states, they're new, right? In North Carolina, we're talking about a 300% increase in the Latino population over the past 10 years, right? But even in longstanding states, politicians and people who want to help and who want to, educate and engage this population don't know how to reach them. So I did. I was a journalist, and I knew how to, talk to the community and reach them. So I decided to help Democrats. We passed the DREAM Act in 2010. I was on the floor of the House of Representatives when it passed, and I was in the Senate when it failed. Mm-hmm. And then I became the spokesperson for President Obama on immigration. But again, at all of these levels, really being cognizant of how little people really know about this community and their issues, and trying to serve as a conduit for people to understand them better.
I think it's still true that many people know very little or nothing about these communities. And you hit on, I think, the reason why, or one of the reasons why, which is stories of these communities, people living in these communities, do not get the same kind of play on media, national media, TV, whatever medium you want to choose, as, sort of the stereotypical hackneyed, criminal coming across the border thing.
Yeah.
Why? I mean, that would seem to suggest that there is some type of bias, a pretty deep bias, in at least the mainstream media.
Yeah. Look, I mean, I've done a lot of research on this, and I've done actually, my journalism thesis was on how representation of minorities and immigrants in newsrooms directly affect what is published and the coverage they do. So I think a lot of it has to do with representation within newsrooms. If you watch Univision, if you watch Telemundo, or if you watch their English language spinoffs, you will see Latino doctors, mm-hmm. Latino professors, Latino undocumented immigrants, you will see the gamut of the community. If you watch mainstream media, when I started my advocacy in 1998, Hispanics were less than 3% of images on television, less than 3%. And of those, 80% were gang members, right. criminals, or B-roll of people crossing the border, mm-hmm. which is not how they cross, right? We're in 2018. We are now less than 2% of the images on television, less than 0.7% of the images on news, mainstream news. So you wonder, in the absence of reality, in the absence of truth and of a story, propaganda prevails.
Yeah.
And what we're seeing, obviously, from this president is he's using every single opportunity he has to malign this community. He started his campaign with it.
Yeah.
If we don't counter that, if that isn't countered in the public space, on television, et cetera, that becomes truth. Mm. And that's the scary part.
So how is that countered? I mean, this is a large issue, this underrepresentation of actual valid stories of real people,
yeah,
as opposed to what you were talking about. How do you counter that? I mean, this seems to be a significant hurdle that needs to be overcome somehow. And I wonder if you have any clues as to what the answers would be.
I think part of it is education, right? I don't think that a lot of people know this and recognize this, right? So now they're going to be looking on camera and on television for Latinos and for minorities and be like, wait, what's going on? Yeah. Channel, whatever it is, right? So part of it is education. There's definitely national groups that are working towards this. And really, it's public pressure. I mean, look what happened on MSNBC. MSNBC, when they, you know, started this election, when President Trump became President Trump, they got rid of all of their minority and immigrant staff on air. If it wasn't for the Twitter campaign to save Melissa Harris Perry, mm-hmm, and everybody who said, no, absolutely not, we need people of color, Joy Reid wouldn't have her show. That was directly correlated to the public pressure. So it takes people getting informed, and it takes people demanding, just like we demand more from our politicians, demanding more from the news stations that shape our view of the world.
Mm-hmm. You spent some time on the U.S.-Mexico border, mm-hmm, with a HBO documentary film crew. Mm-hmm. Tell us what you saw there.
It was a really, really, how would you call it, kind of bipolar kind of reality. So I was there to be the field producer of a documentary film on how our democracy works as seen through the lens of immigration reform. So I went to Arizona to find those folks that were most interested in changing our immigration law, whether it be in the benefit of immigrants or against immigrants, right? Arizona is obviously, you know, one of the ground zeros of the border. Mm-hmm. Border policy in the United States has made it so that it's nearly impossible to cross all of the border of Arizona because of all the funding and all of the equipment and, mm-hmm, and manpower that is down there. The only part of the Arizona border that they can't put something on belongs to a Native American tribe. So what's ended up happening, and what was happening at the time when I lived there, is that all of the immigrants were being funneled through this one little space where they couldn't put up a wall,
wow,
which also happened to be the most dangerous part of the desert, which is why we saw deaths go up, which is why all this stuff started happening. So one day I would literally be dropping off water and food in different stations where we knew migrants would go desperately for help. And the next day, I would be at a gun show with people literally, you know, playing Kill the Mexican, right? Vigilante groups that were on the border wanting to harm Mexicans as they were crossing. So it was a reality that confronted me daily. Every single drive, I drove, you know, 5-6 hours a day from point to point. Every single drive, I would find migrants on the side of the road with, you know, their hands behind their back on the floor. And I think one of the most surprising things to me was throughout all these travels, I would turn the radio on, right? I have 6 hours to drive. This is prior to many technological advances. The only thing that I could hear on vast swaths of that border was Clear Channel. And the only thing that Clear Channel was playing was Rush Limbaugh. Mm. How can we expect folks to have a different opinion or to have an informed opinion about this issue if all we have is inflammatory, quite racist, people on the radio talking to them? That's where I decided to become a journalist.
Wow, powerful. Underlying all of these issues are a subset of issues, which is economic disparity, educational disparity, and other disparities between the Latino population and the non-Latino population, certainly the white population. And you've specialized in those. Talk just in general, what are these disparities? What is the extent?
Yeah, I was in for a surprise when I arrived in Rhode Island. The second week I was here, a report comes out saying that if you put a Latino student in Rhode Island, they have the worst chance of succeeding in the nation. We haven't had enough English language learner teachers since 1992 in the state.
And that's true in other states as well, certainly.
And that's true in other states. And then when you add economic disparities, housing segregation, lack of health, lack of educational attainment, Rhode Island is in the top 10 worst places to live in the United States if you're Hispanic. So these are systemic problems. These are endemic. There are states that have figured this out, and we have best practices that we can model ourselves off of.
What would one or two of those states be?
California is obviously leading the way on a lot of things. On dual language immersion, it's Iowa, I believe. I'm sorry, it's Utah. Dual language immersion, because of Governor Huntsman, when he was the governor, has been from the top given a priority, so much so that they have some of the strongest bilingual schools in the nation. Everywhere in the, you know, the country, there's examples. But I think the important thing is that we are having this conversation now in Rhode Island and in New England. There are op-eds, there are people speaking out, they're saying we have to stop, and we have to stop and look at this particular community and see how we can help them.
We need to take a quick moment for station identification. This is Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. An audio version of this program airs three times every weekend on Sirius XM Satellite Radio's popular Politics of the United States. That's the POTUS channel, number 124. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University in beautiful Newport, Rhode Island. If you want to connect with me on Twitter, you can find me at JM Lutis. To my right is my friend and co-host, G. Wayne Miller, who's an award-winning journalist with the Providence Journal, who also recently completed his 17th book. He's on Twitter too, at G. Wayne Miller, all one word. Our guest this week is Gabriela Domenzain, the director of the Latino Policy Institute at Roger Williams University. You can catch her on Twitter at Gabby Domenzain, G-A-B-I-D-O-M-E-N-Z-A-I-N. You know, in the President's State of the Union address recently, he advanced some myths, right? And one of the myths that I heard was the equation of undocumented immigrants with criminality. Can you talk about the truth of that?
That it's not true. All of the studies show, and we have very longitudinal studies since immigrants and Mexicans have been here for a very long time, all the studies show that the higher the immigrant population, the higher the two-parent households, and the lower the crime. And that's what I'm saying about this. This is what we're seeing come out of the president's mouth and officials' mouth is anti-immigrant propaganda. It has to be said as such. I'm not using words lightly. He starts an office vice the first a week that he's in. He starts an office that is dedicated just to reporting crimes to public committed by undocumented immigrants. Yeah. Every single opportunity he has to vilify and to scapegoat the community he does,
He began his campaign. I mean, his very first campaign speech was drug dealers and rapists coming over the border from Mexico.
Yeah. And then build the wall.
And then build the wall.
Yeah. Yeah.
So why are large percentages of Americans accepting these proclamations and statements and actions without questioning them?
I think it has to do with how long the federal government has just remained completely dysfunctional and inactive on this issue. The last time we passed comprehensive immigration reform legislation was 1986.
Right.
Madonna and Sean Penn were married.
That puts it in context for sure.
It was the year of the Challenger. We're talking, I was in third grade,
Reagan was president.
Exactly.
Right? But why though? Because when you get all of the different parties, or most of the different parties together or not together and talk privately with them, everyone agrees virtually without exception, and the president even does, that we need immigration reform. It isn't happening. Why? This is 30-some years.
But isn't part of that story, though, that some people don't want there to be immigration reform because it is such an effective issue for political mobilization? Mm-hmm. Is that fair?
I mean, that is. It's, I think that you hear that more from the right, obviously, that they say, the kind of the cynics of the world that say...
That could be a little projection, too, though.
If it's done by Democrats, then, Latinos will all vote for the Democrats forever. I mean, the Republican Party has no chance with Latinos right now.
Right.
I mean, they have the most anti-immigrant racist president in the history of this country, and Latinos recognize that they're scapegoats, right? So why is it? Has it been used for political purposes? Absolutely. Democrats and Republicans are both to blame on this. Republicans Unfortunately, and I think that this was a backlash to President Obama being elected, but Republicans did a concerted effort to go around the country and recruit the most extreme candidates that they could. And among those things are immigration, right, and how they speak about it. So we are talking about the Tea Party and the you know, very, very right fringe extreme caucus that is now in the middle of the Republican Party. It used to be fringe.
The fringe.
And now it's actually front and center. Not only that, it's leading the United States and the country and abroad via its president. So that's one thing. On the Democratic side, they haven't decided to use their political capital on this issue, right? The president, President Obama, tried his first year. It didn't work. He decided to go with health care reform, which, by the way, was the number one priority for Latino voters, right? Because we are the most underinsured and uninsured population. So for those that, you know, I understand that President Obama needs a little bit of pushback, but he decided to go with health care. Makes sense. And wasn't able to get comprehensive immigration reform because of what we already know that Senator McConnell said. They wanted to make him a one-term president and block everything. The other part, I think, is Latino political, you know, Latino voter participation, right? We have historically low participation rates. I think that's a chicken or the egg. Democrats are definitely not doing what they need to do to reach out to Latinos and to get them informed, and Republicans aren't either. So I think a lot of that is at play, but I mean, I don't know. What do you guys think is going to be able to pass Congress right now?
Well, when, you know, we know that there's John McCain from Arizona and Tim Kunz have a compromise piece of legislation. But we also know that the Speaker of the House of Representatives said that the House will not even consider a piece of legislation that the president indicates he won't support. So you're just sort of, you're a lot of people making a lot of sound and fury, but it doesn't seem like you're going anywhere anytime
soon.
And
all of this because of the wall, correct? The wall that Mexico was going to pay for, A. And B, for historical purposes, there is more money sent to Border Patrol and border enforcement than all other law enforcement agencies combined. Net migration from Mexico is zero. The reason people are coming here is there are jobs. If there are no jobs, they do not come. So it's just, it's, and I think, you know, kind of the time calls for moral leadership. For me, this is, you know, my friends kind of, they don't get, you know, get mad, but they definitely make a little bit of fun of me because this is the thing that keeps me up at night, right? Reading these stories and talking to people who have no rights that are just trying to do what everybody in this country was trying to do when they immigrated here is what keeps me up at night. But for folks like me that have been following this issue and who vote on this issue, you know, we're sitting here scratching our heads saying, how come nobody's defending who we are as a country? So he can say all these negative things, but where are these leaders that are saying, wait a second, these are just like me. This is the new Irish, this is the new Italian, and leaning into it. That's what I'm seeing the community want in Rhode Island and elsewhere, and I'm not seeing that nationally.
Nationally, there has been a case that has surfaced regarding Lillian Calderon, and you've become involved in that. Talk about that briefly, what happened to this woman, why, and where it might stand. And does this represent the future of additional actions by ICE?
Yeah. I have been involved. So Lillian is a Rhode Islander. She's been here since she was 3 years old. Married her high school sweetheart in 2016. She has two children, one and four. And they were trying to, Lewis and her were trying to start her process to get her permanent status in this country because obviously they've been married and, you know. And so they got an appointment at USCIS, which is United States Citizenship and Immigration Service, to verify their marriage. They went to their appointment. They walked in. The officer said everything was fine. Lillian, you know, they approved all the, because this is a vetting process. We don't just approve marriages. You have to show pictures. You have to, you know, have interviews, all this stuff. Everything was fine. And then on their way out, the officer says, actually, there's a colleague here to wait, waiting for you. Lillian turns around, and it was an ICE officer, and she was literally vanished from her community without any explanation. Nobody told her why. basically what the United States government is doing now.
Well, what happened to her? Did she disappear? She went to a detention facility, correct?
Yeah, she went to immigrant detention. She went to a prison. She's in a cell with one or two other women, depending on the night. And basically the legal kind of case began at that point to see how we could get her out. Most cases like this, traditionally what we know, our immigration system is very gendered. So what we know is that usually in cases like Lillian's, a woman who has been here since three years old, has two children that are citizens, a husband that are citizen, when that case comes to ICE, if it's a woman and they have children, they usually release them on an ankle bracelet. Monitoring, right? If it's a man, tough luck, and they go into prison. Mm. What we're seeing now, and when you were talking about a trend, is about five different cases in New England where ICE is waiting outside marriage verification ceremonies to pick up the person that is trying to get right by the law. Right? So there was something that was in a lawsuit today, the ACLU lawsuit, which took it to the federal level, which I thought was really interesting. It's like the federal government from the right hand is asking you to come, and with the left hand is snatching you, right? These are the laws that we have in place for folks like Lillian and Luis to be able to stay together. Recently, the ACLU filed what is called a federal habeas corpus case. And that's what it's saying to the federal, the federal government is saying to immigration, wait a second, did she have due process?
Right.
Was she able to prove her case? In this case, it's a no. So a judge recently ruled that she's not allowed to be deported from this country until her case is heard. So we're, doing everything we can. And on the community end, that's what's been really, really, really impressive and heartwarming. About being here. I found out about this on an Acela back from New York. I tweeted it, and within 3 hours, there was an emergency meeting in South County called that was moved to a venue because we needed more people, and Luis and I, the next night, were standing before 100 people that are mad, that are concerned, and that are ready to act.
They want something to happen. We need to end it there. Gabriela Domenzain, thank you so much for being with us. She's at the Latino Policy Institute at Roger Williams University. That's all the time we have this week, but if you want to know more about Story in the Public Square, you can always catch up with us on Facebook and Twitter, or you can visit us at pellcenter.org. He's Wayne, I'm Jim. We'll see you again next week for more Story in the Public Square.